Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Caroline Gilby.
Gilby, yes, I'm fine, thank you, Chris.
Excellent. We're going to talk a wee bit about Eastern Europe. Last week we talked a wee bit about Central European. I mistakenly called them Eastern Europe, because I always think of sort of, you know, Yugoslavia, Slovenia, all as sort of Eastern Europe. But there are European countries even further east, aren't there?
There are, yes. And I think these countries perhaps are not so keen nowadays on being regarded as the former Eastern Bloc. But to be fair, they were.
I tell you what, you watch Eurovision Song Contest, and as soon as they stop voting like an Eastern Bloc, then I think they'll get called an Eastern Bloc. Do they not vote like an Eastern Bloc?
Well, there are some huge cultural differences between these countries, which I find absolutely fascinating, because I do think we have this perception that it was all Eastern Europe and therefore it must all be the same. But, you know, for instance, if you look at Romania and Bulgaria, who, you know, share a border basically at the Danube, Romania is a Latin country with a Latin language and actually with a pretty strong wine culture. Bulgaria is a Slavic country with a Cyrillic alphabet and actually is much more a spirits culture, even though they're a big wine producer.
The Cyrillic alphabet, that's the one with all the B's going backwards and all that crazy. That's the same script as the Russians use, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it is, yes.
What are the key countries in Eastern Europe? Is it Eastern Europe the right name then?
I think Eastern Europe is fair enough now, though. I think it's, you know, it is worth noting that Romania and Bulgaria are in fact the two newest members of the European Union. They joined in January 2007.
Yep.
Neither of them are in the Eurozone, but they are full members of the EU and have had an enormous amount of EU investment in the sort of run-up to joining the EU to, you know, bring their industries, wine industries being critical there, up to the level of the European Union. So we've seen huge, huge investments in vineyards and in winemaking equipment, which really has made a huge difference to the quality of the wine that's coming out of these countries.
Bulgaria, I've heard about. Romanian wines, again, I've heard about. There's a wine called No Man's Land, I think it was, from Romania.
That's from Bulgaria. And that's been, being produced in the south of the country in by a company called Damianitsa, who have vineyards in what was the border zone between Greece and Bulgaria. And in fact, you can still see the fences and the watchtowers and so on towering above the vineyards in No Man's Land.
I remember that was one of the first Eastern European wines I tried, and I thought it was actually pretty decent.
They're making some nice wines, that particular wine. And there are actually generally nowadays, I think Bulgaria is producing the best wines that it has done in, you know, the couple of decades or so that I've been interested in Eastern European wines. And it is partly because they've now realized that they have to own vineyards to control fruit quality. Because what happened after the Iron Curtain came down, Bulgaria in particular decided to try and give back the land to the people who had owned those exact bits of land before World War II. And that means that the problem being that, you know, paperwork maybe isn't all that accurate. Families have split up. Different generations have come through. And then there have been arguments about, well, you might own the land, but we planted the vines. So who owns those? Kind of. So it actually took them over 10 years to get to grips with land restitution.
Yep.
And as a result, they ended up with an industry that had been, you know, large-scale collectivized vineyards, large-scale collectivized wineries that actually were producing really quite drinkable, good value, varietal wines. You know, and at their peak, we were drinking 4.5 million cases of Bulgarian wine in the UK because, you know, it was varietal, it was easy to understand, it was cheerful, it was drinkable, and it was fair price. Unfortunately,
and they don't seem to have the Cyrillic script in there.
Though I mean, they were quite switched on about, you know, using English script and say varietal labelling before the New World did it, so that, you know, it was easy to understand what you were buying.
Yep.
The problem of, say, the result of the land restitution process meant that you ended up with very fragmented vineyard holdings, often belonging to people who had no interest in viticulture at all, or no knowledge of how to maintain vines. So the whole sort of growing side of the business kind of fell into disrepair, and some of the worst maintained vineyards I've seen in my life, because people weren't doing it professionally, and it was also obvious. Very difficult for the wineries to get hold of, therefore, the quality that they needed, or the consistent quality and supply. So the raw materials weren't any good. So the quality of wine went down really quite steeply at a time when the new world came along and was doing these soft, ripe, fruity, varietal wines, kind of doing what Bulgaria used to do and marketing it better. So Bulgaria now sells probably fewer than 250,000 cases in the UK. So, you know, it's a real fragment of what it used to be. And it's difficult for the country then to claw its way back from, because its niche has been filled. So having said that, I mean, what we've seen in the last 5 or 6 years is wineries, often with the help of EU money, have worked really hard on actually buying vineyards and putting together decent sized plots that they can manage professionally. And just, you know, to use one example of a winery called Besar Valley, whose wine Anira is available in Waitrose and Ocado. They have 200 hectares of land, and they had to deal with 600 growers or landowners to put that together in one place. So you can imagine the sort of legal paperwork and the chasing down owners and so on to actually get that sort of consolidated vineyard has been enormous. But a lot of people have done that. They've realized they need to own their vineyards. So there's been a complete sea change really in Bulgaria in what's happening in the winemaking.
And has the quality come up accordingly?
Quality has come up enormously, yes.
And has the prices come up? Because anything, as soon as you integrate into Europe, everything goes up in terms of price.
Yes, so and one of Bulgaria's problems is their currency is tied to the euro, which means that for us, buying their wines, with the pound not being worth much anymore, it does make buying wines from Bulgaria more expensive than it has
that
been.
It does with Australia as well.
Yeah.
Would you say that Bulgaria competes with Australia in that positioning, or...? Where would you say, but how would you position Bulgaria?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because there's not enough really Bulgarian wine in this market at the moment to see where they are trying to compete. I mean, they ought to be able to compete with Australia, but they perhaps struggle a little bit at the bottom end of the market. Well, again, it comes back to this question of quality costs wherever you are.
Yeah.
And there is some reasonably ambitious pricing in in Bulgaria. So most of the better producers, I think, wouldn't necessarily want to be competing at the £3 to £4 sort of range nowadays.
Okay. And where do they export their wines to, or do they not export, or who?
Well, no, they are nationally quite a big exporting country, and a lot still goes to Russia.
Yep.
Obviously, they've been trade partners, and they share an alphabet and so on. So it's quite an easy country to go export to. Some still going to sort of places like Germany and the Benelux countries, but like the UK, a lot less than they used to be. So, I think a lot of Bulgaria's efforts would be, Poland is another important market for them, very important market for them, and places like Belarus and Ukraine and some of the sort of former Soviet states still remain important.
Let's move north into Romania now, and Latin script.
Yeah, yeah.
Romanian wines.
Yeah.
What's the big picture here?
Right. Well, the big picture is Romania is actually one of the pretty big producers. I mean, I think they're number 6 in terms of vineyard area in Europe. But that's slightly disingenuous because their area of actual proper Vitis vinifera is only about 90,000 hectares. They've still got a big area of hybrid vines that are used for sort of domestic market production, but they're obviously going to be uprooted and got rid of gradually now they're members of the EU. So big picture in Romania is that it's a big wine drinking nation as well as a big producing nation. So again, they have switched from being a major, major exporter. I mean, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, we drank a lot of Romanian Pinot Noir, for instance, in this country. Nowadays, Romania is actually a net importer of wine. Because it's a big population, they do have a wine drinking habit. You know, it goes with their perhaps more Roman Latin culture.
Do you know how many litres of wine are?
Well, they're drinking officially about 23 litres a head, which is.
Well, England's about 30.
England's about 27 to 30, depending on whose numbers you look at. But of course, there's an awful lot still of, you know, you travel around Romania and you see wine for sale on the roadsides, and that doesn't appear in anybody's official statistics.
Flagons of wine.
Yeah, flagons. And some of that is in education, I'll tell you.
With your sophisticated palate, have you found them to be good for cooking with?
A friend of mine actually did make me taste a selection of homemade wines once, because he said I needed to understand what the local market palate was and what they were used to tasting, and therefore why it's quite difficult to communicate to some of these growers, if they're used to drinking this homemade stuff, what you want them to do in the vineyards to produce these wines for Western markets. So it was an education, because there was every fault in the winemaking book there, and they were just grim.
Really? So would you say that the winemaking is a professional business in Romania, or is it very much my dad did it, I've followed his recipe? And
no, it is a professional business. There are some very big players, and there are some medium-sized players who are perhaps the most dynamic sector actually in Romania, and have recently got together to form a new wine association to, you know, raise the profile of the new generation of Romanian wines. Again, vineyards have been critical, replacing the old sort of communist concrete winemaking equipment has been critical, and again EU money has gone in quite substantially.
Sure. And what are the key regions or grape varieties?
Yeah, well, key grape varieties, I think there are quite a lot of international grape varieties in Romania, which are not newcomers. They've been there for over 100 years. So, you know, Pinot Noir, particularly planted for making sparkling wine originally, Cabernet, Merlot, Chardonnay, Sauvignon, are all, you know, well, have a long track record in Romania. Of the local grape varieties, you've got a bunch of grapes called Fatasca. You've got Fatasca Negra, which is the black maiden grape, which has a lot of potential, I think, as a sort of signature grape for Romania, maybe particularly in blends, where it gives a real sort of sense of place along with, you know, your Cabernets and Merlots. If you can put some Fatasca in there, you've got something that's uniquely Romanian, not just competing as another international Bordeaux blend.
Structure-wise?
Structure-wise, it reminds me actually quite a bit of Sangiovese, because it has that kind of bright cherry fruit and acidity that you get from Sangiovese.
Not too heavy.
Tannins can be quite firm, and that's the key to making it well, is managing the tannins so that they're not too hard.
Okay.
So that's why it's quite good in a blend with as
Merlot
well.
Or something to soften it out.
Then on the white front, so you've got Fatasca Alba, and then its daughter, which is Fatasca Regala. Both can make some very attractive, actually, quite drinkable. I mean, not super high quality, but appealing wines.
Yep.
And then you've had quite a lot of planting recently of sort of modern clones of Pinot Noir.
So less designed for sparkling wine.
Less designed for sparkling wine, but, you know, proper Dijon clones for red wine production. Yeah. Again,
it makes a heck of a difference with Pinot, getting the right clone.
It certainly does. And also sort of moving plantings of Pinot Noir from the, you know, the hot regions like Delulmare and Dobrogea down in the southeast of the country, but actually planting in Transylvania, for instance, which is traditionally a white area because it's quite mountainous, but actually is looking really exciting for Pinot Noir.
Transylvania, oh, he's got funny memories of watching vampire movies and things.
Well,
like
it's a fascinating area to visit. I mean, I remember going once and sort of driving through all these snow-covered pine forests and graveyards in amongst the trees, and of course they have wolves and they have bears still there, so you do sort of sense where the legends have come from.
Transylvania is sort of in the middle of the country.
Right in the middle of the country, yes, yeah, surrounded by mountains, the Carpathians. And then another quite interesting area is sort of over in the west of the country towards the Hungarian border, sort of Banat and around the area of Rakash, around Timișoara particularly, which was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire previously. So it's, it's perhaps a little bit more western in its approach.
Any other regions that we should be keeping an eye out for?
Yeah, well, down, I say, in the far southwest of the country, you've got sort of some good, couple of good producers. Carl Ray from Germany have invested quite heavily down here. And then there's another new producer, a good producer down at Sagarcha near Craiova. Coronet Sinuk Sagarcha means the Crown Estates of Sagarcha. Yeah. Not an easy name for the British market, though. And then, of course, it would be fair also to mention Kotnar from the northeast of the country, which is kind of, that's the famous area for sweet wines from Romania.
I didn't know Romania made sweet wines.
Yeah, well, they tend to be drunk in the domestic market. I mean, they like to claim it's their sort of equivalent of Tokaj, but most of the wines produced there are sort of medium, semi-sweet, semi-dry. So I don't think they really do compete with Tokaj, to be honest.
And any particular grape varieties from that area of the world?
Well, Grassa de Cotnar, which is, it's their local grape variety. And another thing called Frankuska.
Grassa, is that white or red?
Grassa, they're both white. So Grassa is capable of actually making really intense sweet wines with botrytis. You see it also grown as Kovasolo in Hungary. Another really Grassa is easier to pronounce. It means the fat grape. So, okay.
Because the volume size of the grape.
Quite big berries and quite high sugar, but also prone to noble rot.
Fantastic. Yep. Okay, and that's pretty much it for Eastern Europe. There's other.
Well, I think I would like to mention Moldova as well, which is, it's confusing because there's the Republic of Moldova, and then there's the region of Moldova, which is in Romania. Now, the Republic of Moldova was part of the Soviet Union. It wasn't just Eastern Bloc like Romania. And Moldova gained its independence in 1991.
Yep.
And, I mean, it's such a fascinating country in many ways because the grapevine is incredibly important in Moldova. 25% of the population at least earned their living from something to do with wine production and grape growing. It was their biggest export after its expat workers until the Soviet Union, well, Russia, I should say, turned around and banned all Moldova's wines in March 2006.
I remember that.
And considering they were selling, 95% or something of their production to Russia, for a country that makes its living from wine, this was an absolute disaster.
So what happened?
Well, quite a lot. I mean, there've been a lot of bankruptcies, a lot of people falling out of the grape growing business, people focusing, I suppose, on trying to find other markets, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, Belarus, places like that. And again, it was a problem waiting to happen because Moldova was shipping cheap, nasty, badly made, semi-sweet wine to Russia. So it was cheap, and as long as it had alcohol in it, and it was cheap enough, the Russians would buy it at that point. So they've had to sort of relook at their business model and making better quality wines for different markets.
Yep.
The market with Russia has reopened, but it's nothing like the volume it was before. And there's really, I think, only one producer that's shipping to the UK, a company called Acarex, who are based down in the south, who have sort of organic certified vineyards, and they're producing actually some really cracking wines that are sold through Direct Wines and Laithwaite's. Particularly Pinot Grigio is very good, really lovely sparkling wine called Cuvée Alexandre, nice super Sauvignon Blanc as well.
I've heard of Cuvée Alexandre. Mm. I haven't tasted it, but I've heard of it. At least I've heard of one of them.
They've got a French consultant in there sort of helping them work, and an Italian viticultural consultant. So they're really focusing on what they can do to sort of meet our Western requirements, as it were.
Okay. Originally, though, Moldova had a lot of French people planting the vines.
It did, yes. It had very good strong connections with with France, and hence the sweet wines that are traditionally produced in Moldova, called variously Cahor or Cagor, are sort of linked with French residents wanting wines that they'd been used to getting from the southwest of France.
Do they have any unique grapes or...?
Quite a lot of similarities, really, with Romania. So Fătașca particularly. Really, they've got a couple of unique grapes. Think called Rara Negra, which is produced in very small quantities but goes into Negru de Păcar, which is kind of quite a legendary wine in Moldova.
So there's an old saying in New Zealand.
Yeah, world famous in Moldova. Yeah,
world famous in Moldova.
And also they have a thing called Bastardo, which is not the same as Bastardo in Portugal, but it was produced as a cross somewhere in the Soviet Union in Soviet times, and actually produces some quite interesting red wines.
I can imagine that's selling quite well in some cities in England.
At least you can pronounce it, you know. So, it's something that we might see a bit of in the UK.
Excellent. And the last big sort of Eastern European wine producing country is Georgia, really, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, it's fascinating contrast, actually, between Moldova and Georgia, because they're both countries that were part of the Soviet Union. To be fair, I should mention that Georgia isn't actually in Europe, whereas Moldova is. Though I think they see themselves as quite a European nation, really, yep. And have ambitions towards being much closer to Europe. But again, very different culturally to anywhere else I've been, really. I mean, they've got this fantastic long history of grape production dating back, they have carbon dated grape pips back to 7,000 years ago as cultivated grapes. And they have some fantastic, archaeological evidence of winemaking culture going back, 7,000 or 8,000 years in Georgia. So arguably it's where it all started.
Where was the home of, because it is around that Georgia
area?
Well,
certainly, that area of the Fertile Crescent from sort of Anatolia in what's now Turkey up through Armenia and into Georgia does seem to be where the grapevine was first cultivated and where wine culture started.
Yeah.
And each of them would like to claim that it was their country, but certainly that area.
Excellent. And grape varieties in Georgia similar to...
Yeah, well, they claim to have 525 indigenous grape varieties that nobody else
Italian.
grows. But only about you only actually see about 10 or 15 of them in commercial production at the moment. In terms of reds, Saporavi is the real find, because it's a really exciting grape variety, capable of making some super high quality wines. Black cherries, nice acidity. It gets ripe without being too alcoholic. Some really exciting wines. Whites, a lot of Riccazatelli and Mezzavani. Mezzavani, I think, is more interesting grape than Riccazatelli, which I don't really like. But it was tended to be grown in Soviet times for its yields.
Yeah.
What we are starting to see is more of the unusual grape varieties appearing. So Solicuri, Kissi, Titska, a few other things.
Is that to meet local demands?
Yes, I think, because, they've got this heritage of grape varieties, so it'd be nice to actually see them growing some of the ones with more character.
Yeah, exactly.
yeah, definitely. Fantastic scenery, great architecture, really interesting, and very unusual food as well. But a real wine culture in Georgia. They have this culture of having a toastmaster who encourages people to drink wine throughout a meal, and it's very much based on wine.
All right, then. I think we're going to wrap it up there, Caroline. Is that all right?
Yes.
Thank you
very
much for
you for letting me tell you all about my exciting travels in Eastern Europe.
Excellent. Cheers very much, Caroline.